Okay, we're going to get started. We had a change of our schedule. You may have noticed that A&E dropped off, and at the last minute, Jay Rizzullo and Lowell Singer from the Walt Disney Company agreed to change their schedules to be here. So I thank both of you. Jay actually flew in today. So thank you, Jay. Thank you, Lowell, for agreeing to do this.
You're welcome, Michael.
Really appreciate it.
This is the first time I've appeared with Lowell, so you guys are seeing a not-ready-for-prime-time duo.
I got to figure out who do I address. I'll start with Jay. I think Ted just answered this question, but I'll ask you again. So in what has been a really difficult environment for media, and I showed that earlier in my presentation, Disney's firing on all cylinders. You know, what do you think is setting you guys apart from the rest of the group, and what's driving your success at this point in time, given the backdrop?
Well, I think that those of you who have followed the company for a long time will see a certain consistency. 8-9 years ago, Bob Iger laid out a crystal clear strategy about content, about embracing technology, and taking our brands, franchises, and products into a bigger global footprint. And we have really stuck to that. But the interesting thing about that strategy is that the depth of it has really been executed extremely well, but has really held up even in a rapidly evolving marketplace. I mean, the fact that, you know, Ted just left and Netflix, I mean, when we thought through that strategy, you know, Netflix was not even an idea. No less, was it taking, were we thinking of selling original content to that platform? But we have, you know, invested behind that strategy. We've kind of invested for the long term, ignored business cycles, have followed sort of a true north in terms of what we know we're good at, what we think consumers would want. We've really embraced technology in a very significant way and thought about, well, as this universe expands, we can either stick to the ecosystem that has been so beneficial to our company, or we can be more consumer-focused and look at how we can play kind of across the spectrum. I think we've acquired well. I think we've acquired according to that strategy. We've done, two fundamental types of acquisitions. One, to expand our IP universe such that it covers more of the bases fully. I'm sure Ted talked about Marvel. That's a perfect example. 10 years ago, in meetings like this, we'd be asked about, gee, you're very strong with girls, not so much with boys. What are you doing to address that? I think we've covered that incredibly well. With Star Wars, we've continued to look towards very high-quality family entertainment. And I think that we have used our balance sheet and our capacity, our debt capacity, to really invest strongly behind what we have competitive advantage in, what we're good at. As it turns out, it's worked well for us. We've used a franchise-focused strategy, which is, I think, very unique to us because we're a company with a very long tail on where we monetize the assets that we create. So we create something like Avengers, we create these superheroes in the theatrical window, and if you look across the tail of all of our businesses, whether it's in the television business, the theme park business, the consumer products business, we really look at every aspect of our uniquely linked together ecosystem to monetize the creative that comes out of the company. So I think it really sets us apart from, excellent actors in each aspect of the business, but I think that we've managed to, both from an attitudinal perspective, investment perspective, and talent perspective, to really string it all together. Right. And I think that, we used to talk about the Disney difference. It sounds like kind of an old saw at this point, but it really is what differentiates us in the space.
Another thing that differentiates you was two things. One, a lack of guidance, and two, And two,
which, by the way, we're not going to alter to that.
Right, exactly. Well, Lowell's here.
Exactly.
And the second thing was, you know, as hard as we tried to push you to nail down an annual buyback number, you only gave it, I think, only once in the past decade, we had a buyback number. Do you think those two factors, that you were not tied to guidance or a number, has allowed you to be more flexible, more strategic in the past couple of years?
Well, I think that when you don't tie yourself to, you know, a quarterly or annual guidance on each of the many aspects that we would have to do, you'd have to do if we did that, it really allows you the flexibility to be responsive to changes in the marketplace. I think that what we've tried to say over and over again is that we really are long-term focused. And if you're long-term focused, you don't want to be thinking every time that you're making a long-term decision that, oh, what did I say again about the next 6 months or the next year or the next three-year trajectory? You know what? This is a better idea, higher value creation for shareholders, and it's not going to live up to that. And now what? I'm going to go back and refresh. It's just not worth the effort. I think that we've tried to be crystal clear about how we make decisions, why we make decisions, and then give all of you the opportunity to differentiate yourself and distinguish yourself on figuring out how those pieces fit together and come up with our numbers. So it's has served us well. I don't think we have any intention to depart from that. And I don't think we've ever, you know, not from my time, I've been with the company for 30 years, I never remember being capital constrained during that period. We don't really have sort of that worry as a company. But we do carefully consider where we put our money and don't feel like we want to tie ourselves down to very short-term objectives.
Okay. I think, Michael, you could imagine that during the downturn, had we been tied to guidance, we might not have had the ability to go out and do Marvel.
Right.
So I think we've tried to be opportunistic, and I think guidance certainly can tie our hands in terms of some of those important investment decisions.
And even in buybacks, and I've asked you guys both publicly in buybacks, you know, what's the right number? Like, you always just back away from, like, we're not putting out a number because I think that ties into the same thing, right? You can't buy Lucasfilm if you've got a $5 billion buyback happening.
Yeah, and I think everybody in this room knows that we are committed to returning capital to shareholders. We find a way, whether it's been, you know, significant dividend increases, whether it's been big buyback numbers like last year or our more steady pace of buyback, that we see as one of our objectives in terms of the cash we generate, that we are going to return, you know, 20, 25, 18, whatever the number is for a particular year. But that is the range that we feel comfortable returning capital to shareholders. We consistently do it, and I don't think we have to signal it on an annual basis what exactly our intent is.
Okay. Let me take the Disney difference comment and the long tail of monetization. Some may dismiss Frozen as being a one-off lucky film, or Marvel as a couple of good films strung together. But we wonder, you know, how Disney and Marvel's assets are actually harnessed to drive success. So given that Star Wars is coming out this December, can you walk us through how the Disney divisions actually work together inside the company to create and promote that long tail? Some examples?
Maybe. So, you know, you talk about Frozen, and clearly this is a great example of it. But I think it's just that. It's an example. And we have been committed to this franchise strategy for a long time, and I think there are lots of examples of titles, of IP that we've created around the company that we've been able to exploit in other businesses. If you go back and look at, let's just take Marvel and animation as two examples, because those are where we've invested heavily on the M&A side. If you look at Marvel, since we've owned it, we've put out 8 films. They've averaged, I think we're close to $800 million in global box office per film. And they've been highly acclaimed by critics. I think Rotten Tomatoes scores of 80%. So these are high-quality films. If you look at the animation business, Pixar and Disney collectively, since we bought Pixar, we've put up 13 films, $650 million in global box, 85% Rotten Tomatoes. And the reason I mention that is, you know, Bob has really set a standard of quality, and we think that if we make great content, audiences will follow that content. And they'll follow it not just into the theaters, but they'll follow it into all the other parts of our business. So we have been very deliberate, and we've set up a whole bunch of internal systems and structures to sort of create incentives for business units to work together. So we have internal accounting treatments. So each business has incentives to exploit IP that's created in other businesses. And Jay talked about this earlier, but I think that fully integrated business model allows us to take, you know, where we have a success like Frozen, which we had theatrically, we can then exploit that in many different parts of our businesses, whether it's consumer products or theme parks or, you know, television. The characters were on Once Upon a Time last year. So there are lots of places we can do it. We also invest for the long term behind those franchises, and I think that has led to success as well. The other thing I'd say is that, I mean, I've only been at the company 8 years, but there's greater cross-pollination today than ever. So Bob Chapek, who you know, used to run our home video business. Bob then ran consumer products. He's now running parks. So what better way to create integration around the company than start moving senior executives around? Leslie Ferraro, who was just named to replace Bob running consumer products, has been running marketing at parks for many years, worked for Jay when he ran parks. So I think that the DNA of the company is suited and really sort of targeted in a way where people have, it's not just a financial incentive, but a passion for supporting businesses. And I think what we've learned over the last, you know, really 8-9 years since we bought Pixar is that it's to the company's benefit for everyone to be behind those franchises. So you don't need to direct people to do it now. I think it is really part of the culture and part of the DNA, and everyone feels it, believes it, and gets behind all these franchises. Obviously, Star Wars is really important for us. We are very optimistic. I don't think there'll be a person anywhere who's not aware that that movie is opening in December. And you can imagine that everyone around the company is trying to not only get behind Star Wars, but ultimately benefit from Star Wars. And, you know, that is now how we do things.
Right. Okay. Let me take it to Media Networks. I'll go into some divisions now. Bob spoke on the last earnings call about the variables that shape Disney's philosophy on emerging virtual MVPD products, you know, which ones you're in, which ones you're not. So going back to what you said, Jay, how do you balance the need to keep being innovative, technology-focused, and consumer-friendly in distribution models with the need to maintain the benefits of a bundle that's been very, very good to Disney and the industry? So how do you decide that balance of, you know, where do you go?
Well, interestingly, I think you start right at the top. We don't see those things as mutually exclusive. I think people always want to say, wow, you had, you know, the MVPD system decision with Stars to keep going with that, or you have Netflix and that, you know, that, or which way you're going to go, and is it a conflict? You know, does some of those things conflict? We don't think that utilizing the different means of distribution out there today are in conflict with each other. We think that as a content company, it's our job to figure out how to meet the consumer desire through the distribution capabilities that are out there. So today, you know, at one end of the spectrum, you've got people like blocking their weekend to watch a binge view of something Ted's put up, and they know there are 13 episodes coming out on Friday night, and they're blocking their weekend because they're going to do ultimate long-form viewing. The other end of the spectrum, you've got unbelievable number of eyeballs on Maker Studio and YouTube, you know, and YouTube productions that are 45 seconds. And everything in between exists. And if you're in the business of creating content and you want to be at the top of your game, you really have to look at every single one of those decisions. So what are those decisions? I think, you know, we've always said as content creators that every piece of content has its medium. And, you know, we used to have these big arguments over 2D animation, 3D animation, you know, and people would always ask in rooms like this, not so much anymore, well, does this mean you're done with 2D animation? We always used to say the same thing. You know what? The story and the art form kind of demands a certain execution that will make it as good as it can be. And I think, I know Ted, because I just talked to him on the way out, he was talking about Daredevil and how the buildup of those 4 series that we're doing for Netflix with a culmination in a 5th series. Of course we looked at the ABC network as an opportunity for the distribution of that. And the beautiful thing is that we have so much IP and can create so much content that we really have an embarrassment of riches in terms of where that content is going to show up. And we decided, for both strategic reasons, the type of content it was, what we wanted to do with those characters and those stories, that Netflix was the best home. Of course, I can talk about, you know, the creative process and the strategic process. There's also the financial process of how do we maximize our capabilities in production and creative across the spectrum of opportunities. So I don't think, you know, we are full believers in the MVPD ecosystem, the incredible value it provides to consumers, and we think it's going to be around for a long, long time. Will it be around in exactly the format we see today? Probably not. Probably evolved into, you know, as the whole system has evolved. But we believe that we produce a lot of content that should continue to live there. Live sports being a perfect example of that, but other things, our network television and so on and so forth, our cable channels. But we continue to look at everything from Netflix, hyper long consumption, to Maker Studio at the other end of the spectrum, and ask ourselves, how are our franchises going to manifest themselves in all these different ways consumers look, you know, view media?
Okay. Let me talk about this. ABC, which doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's had great momentum in the past 3 years. What's driving that improvement in profits? And can you give us an update as to what you have that's owned that could mean syndication? So give a sense of the leverage you've shown in the past 3 years has been pretty amazing at ABC.
Yeah, so I think we're making real progress at ABC. And I think, and we've discussed this with, you know, Ben and the ABC team, I think there's a real opportunity there for us moving forward. We talked on the call last week about being a bit ahead of our retrans guidance that we had given for this year. So we're really optimistic in terms of what we're seeing on retrans. There's a great ratings story this year at ABC. Ben talked about this at the upfront yesterday, for those of you who aren't there. I mean, we are, if you look at entertainment programming, which excludes sports, and, you know, we could discuss the merits of looking at it one way or the other, but if you just look at entertainment programming, we're number one season to date. We're the only network to grow ratings season to date. So I think ABC is really building some momentum. I think also from an ABC Studios perspective, you know, this is a great time to be in the content creation business. There are more buyers globally than there have ever been. We are now selling more shows to different partners, whether they're traditional networks or new entrants like Netflix, that will drive significant long-term value for us. And if you look at our fall schedule that Paul Lee announced yesterday, I think about 85% of our scripted hours for the season will be owned by ABC Studios. I think, you know, that is up from, you know, 5 years ago, we were probably 50-50 somewhere in that area. So the studio itself is on a real creative role, and I think that has driven some of the success. Now, there's still a lot more to accomplish. I think they're excited about it. I think the response to the schedule yesterday was real, real positive, and we feel good about that. But I think those are some of the levers that are working in ABC's favor right now. And, you know, I've always said, and you and I have talked about this a lot, that's one of our big, you know, it costs just as much to make a successful show as it does a show that doesn't work. So you're not going to spend a lot more in success, and you drive significantly more value to the bottom line in success. So you've got tremendous leverage in that business to the extent that we're creating shows that are finding meaningful value in secondary and tertiary windows of distribution beyond the network window.
Right. And let me ask you this counterintuitively. If ratings hold up and stay where they are, does a lack of sports cost inflation mean that you actually have greater margin expansion ahead as the retrans ramps? Because everyone else is going to have to pay sports costs. So,
we've made a decision, a conscious decision, to make ESPN the primary sports network of the Walt Disney Company and all the affiliated ESPN networks. We still have some sports on ABC. We have college football on Saturday nights in the fall. We have a bunch of NBA, including the NBA Finals. We announced yesterday at the ESPN upfront that for our wild card game next year, we will simulcast that on ABC. So ABC is still in the sports business, albeit to a much lesser extent than other networks are. And I think your hypothesis is right. I mean, we have said from the beginning that we have greater leverage in that business and greater ability to drop more of that retrans money to the bottom line than other networks do. The cost structure is just different. And it gives us some flexibility in making the investment decisions we want to make on the programming side. And I think thus far, you know, we've been fairly prudent about that. But I think in great success, we will have the ability to drop more to the bottom line.
Let me ask you this one. One of the great frustrations we all have is multi-platform measurement. And just you guys, as you mentioned, were the first to stream content on the ABC.com player. You've worked with Hulu. You've been very aggressive in moving your content multi-platform. We can't get measurement on that at this point in time, but what does your own data show you on the average viewing of multi-platform? And I think that's an untold story for the industry.
Yeah, look, we're up. If you just look at straight C3 ratings, we're up year on year. But I think your multi-platform question is a much more relevant question. And I think traditional ratings metrics are more challenged now than ever because they don't tell the full story. I think about ratings in two ways. We do own the first window of distribution at the network. We monetize that through advertising. The most predominant form of currency today is C3. So C3 helps determine what our network advertising revenue is. Then we sort of look at lifetime value of programs, and I think that is driven by how many people are viewing that content over some period of time. And we'll come back to that in a second, but I think that really drives the long-term value when you're talking about domestic, international syndication, and third-party buyers. We are now trying to aggregate using some third-party data, some of our own data. It's an amalgam, but we're looking at what are live ratings, what are DVR ratings, VOD, online. We're trying to capture that internally over a 30-day period just to get a sense of how much viewing is happening after that first live plus same-day window. And the numbers are pretty dramatic. I mean, it's very interesting. If you look at How to Get Away with Murder, which was a Shonda Rhimes show that we premiered last fall, and you look at the stack of all of those ratings, and you compare it to Grey's Anatomy, which is still on the air, great success for us. That premiered 10 years ago. While fewer people watched How to Get Away with Murder in its live plus same day window, if you aggregate all the people who watched that show in its first 30 days, it did a bigger rating than Grey's Anatomy did 10 years ago. And that gives us great optimism about the long-term value of content. And we're obviously very interested in trying to aggregate those data in a way that third parties will accept them and buy into them and create some language or some baseline that the industry will all buy into, because I think a lot has been written about network television and the challenges it's having, but I think there's a story that really hasn't been told about some of the lifetime value being created by television studios right now, given all that tertiary viewing, and we feel really good about being in that business.
Okay. Let me ask you about the issue. I remember we talked about this a couple times in Burbank. The topic of selling movies and shows to OTT players like Netflix. You made, at the time of the deal, a risky bet selling your pay one movie rights to Netflix, moving it from Stars. Since then, Netflix has continued to grow rapidly, expand its domestic base. As you are now less than a year away from beginning the output deal, maybe a year and a half away, can you discuss how the S-File and the larger ecosystem has evolved since you made the decision to sell? And has your view on selling that changed? Would you go back and say, well, maybe it's too big of a modernization engine, Netflix, and maybe we shouldn't have sold it to Netflix at that point in time?
Well, I don't think we're looking back with regret on that, if that's the gist of your question,
yes.
Michael. As I said, I think we, and Lowell just pointed out, that we've moved to a world where you really have to ask yourself, what is the long-term lifetime value of the content that you produce, and what is the best place to premiere that? People for years have asked us, well, I don't get it. You guys, you say you're in the content business, but you own a network and it's sort of distribution. And I think Lowell just kind of gave a perfect example of why we believe that makes sense for us, because it gives us the opportunity to get a show like How to Get Away with Murder off to an unbelievable running start. And obviously for years and years, companies like Stars within the MVPD system were the way to do that. That is starting to evolve. I mean, Netflix, frankly, what Netflix was when we made that decision was probably a riskier decision than if we had to make that decision today.
Right.
Because of, the number of subscribers, their worldwide growth, the opportunities that we now have with them to take those movies out in the first pay window on a very broad international scale. Probably makes that decision feel a lot better than it felt when we actually made it.
Right.
It was, of course, financially quite advantageous for us to do it when we did it as well. But I think that we feel like, we want to be in a position to put our content with people that can get a lot of eyeballs on it in the run that they have, knowing full well that that probably won't be the last run. I mean, we used to think about, well, you know, a TV show has a life, and then people like Netflix showed up and Hulu showed up, and then we suddenly discovered that, wow, these are new scallops on the demand curve for the viewing of this content. I suspect that'll continue to happen. And the only thing we want to assure ourselves is that where we start, and of course we're talking about movies that start in a theatrical window, but where we start on television has a strong basis of viewers, and we're not locking ourselves in to, you know, putting a bushel basket over our show for 2 years or over our movie for 2 years. And I don't think anyone who's followed the space would ever criticize Netflix of that.
Right.
You know, that was first premiered in, I think, Milan, that song right there. That was an awesome window for it.
Exactly.
We're still listening to it in 2015. Right.
And somebody's getting royalties on that.
Franchise.
Exactly. I think Disney's going to buy, you're gonna buy some
operas.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know what? Superheroes. And you mentioned Hulu. How does Hulu fit, which you guys own a piece of? How does Hulu fit into that world as well versus your other options?
Well, I think having multiple buyers is good for our business. And,
yeah,
you know, we happen to own a piece of Hulu, but we have Hulu, we have Amazon, we have Netflix. You know, multiple buyers in a marketplace is good for content sellers. And we when we have product, we take it to market, we talk to multiple parties. Talk about the studio deal, we talked to Starz, we talked to Netflix, there were other very interested parties. So I think that's one of the benefits of being in the position we and other content owners are in right now, which is, you know, a lot of people come into the table with interesting, attractive offers, and you try to make each decision based on its own merits, but we view Hulu as a buyer. You know, we obviously, you know, we talk financially about both sides of the Hulu coin. We're a seller to Hulu of content. We're an equity participant in Hulu. So, you know, you think about the net economics of all these decisions.
Okay.
You know, the interesting thing, Michael, is because it's kind of an old business model, nobody asks about television studios selling their product to their own network and other networks, right?
Right.
Oh, you know, but it's exactly the same model as reaching out and saying, well, God, you're kind of an MVPD player, so why are you selling to over-the-top guys and insurgents in the space? But it's no different. In other words, we create content at the ABC studio. Some of it we think is great content for ABC. Some of it we think is great content, and we sell it to somebody else. So it's just kind of pulling the same business model forward. It looks and sounds different, but it's been
I think this year we have sold two ABC studio shows airing on other networks, two new ABC studio shows airing on other networks this fall, which is great. I mean, Modern Family is a huge success for ABC.
Right.
It's a much bigger success for Fox.
Right.
So being in the ownership business is really valuable when you have great content. So we're happy to sell to third parties as well.
Okay, talking about the ownership business of great content, given the ramp in superhero projects coming down the pipeline next couple of years, are you worried about superhero fatigue impacting Marvel's growth going forward?
Well, look at us. We're not
fatigued. Yeah. look, that's not something we're worried about. You know, it's funny, I was thinking recently about when I was on the sell side, and DreamWorks got very aggressive in this business. Sony was getting into this business, and I followed Pixar. And I used to get this question all the time about animation. Are you worried about animation fatigue? There's too much animation in the market. And I think what we've learned, and I think what the market has come to appreciate, is great content lifts all boats, right? So more successful animation content is going to help the animation business in general. We talked earlier about, you know, the $650 million we've done in average box for our animated films since the Pixar acquisition. There's a huge marketplace out there. And I think when it comes to Marvel, the same thing applies. You know, we love more great content in the market. And, you know, DC's got a lot of exciting projects in the works. And I think, you know, the better their films are, the better our films are. We all stand to benefit from that. I think at the end of the day, audiences want to go see great films. And Marvel has churned out incredibly high-quality films since really their inception of creating their own films. Under Kevin Feige and Lou Desposito, they've made a bunch of really, really high-quality films, and audiences have shown up, and I don't think that will change. The other thing I'd say about Marvel films, and this is something Kevin said in a meeting we were in not too long ago, all superhero films aren't the same. They're not all created equal. So Captain America was really a period piece. You look at Guardians of the Galaxy, that was really an intergalactic space movie. But they're not all thematically the same, and I think that creates diversity, and audiences don't feel like they're seeing the same movie every time. And if they're fun and exciting and they give great action and, you know, a lot of exciting stories, people will come and see them. So it's not something we talk about at all or at all concerned about.
Okay. Let me just remind you that we're going to take questions from the audience. If Andrew wants to walk down the aisle in like 2 minutes, we'll have Andrew pick up some questions.
Andrew, just so you know, you want to walk down the aisle in 2 minutes.
He does. Also, I said he's graceful, so maintain that gracefulness. Okay, so parks and resorts, Jay, a business that you know very well. We're now seeing the full benefits of many of those capital-intensive projects you helped introduce the park. It was the night of 1,000 dreams, is that the idea? Yeah. And they're starting to generate some meaningful revenues and returns. Can you update us on the impact of these projects? So let's start with cruise ships, Cars Land, Magic Kingdom expansion. Have they impacted how your business?
So, let me start by saying that, that each and every one of those projects you just mentioned and others, you know, were kind of, there wasn't a notion 7 or 8 years ago, hey, let's invest a lot of money in this business. It was, each and every one of them had their own strategic rationale behind them, their own sort of monetization model within that business. Some were an answer to a need, some were purely opportunistic. But each of them was pretty sizable, and they do share that. If we start for no reason whatsoever, but you know, out in California with Disney's California Adventure and the expansion of Cars Land and the kind of retheming of that park, initially that park was introduced with an attempt to be kind of an equal at Disneyland. Disneyland had topped out in terms of capacity. When we opened up Disney's California Adventure, we had an expectation that there would be a certain shifting of the mass of the business. In addition to lifting the numbers, there'd be a certain amount of time spent and a certain amount of the attendance on a daily basis would go over to Disney's California Adventure, spend a certain amount of time that would reduce some of the pressure in different areas of Disneyland that we would be able to backfill. Well, after we opened that park, we found that didn't happen. People were going to DCA, but they're only spending a couple of hours. There's a lot of reasons for that, not worth going into. But we needed a big thematic anchor like Cars Land is, because it is, you know, Disney at its best. You're walking into a world you could never be in the real world. It is a very true reproduction of a very successful film in terms of the space. People recognize it the second they get there. Kids see all the icons that they saw in the movie. And, of course, it has great attractions as part of it. And it is not a coincidence that we put it all the way in the back of the park, right? Because we actually wanted to draw people all the way through and let them experience what was there. And it really did have the dual effect of both lifting the water level in terms of total attendance at the Disneyland Resort, but also relieving some of the congestion at Disneyland. And there was actually, we were at a point of some rejection. It was so congested.
Right.
And so it really did sort of live, that expansion brought Disney's California Adventure to the dream that it always was intended to be. Switch over to Magic Kingdom. You know, statistically, the Magic Kingdom is the most attended theme park in the world. Statistically, at any given moment, 45% of the people in the Magic Kingdom are in Fantasyland.
Right.
It was, again, becoming choked and constrained, and the experience was really being impacted by the amount of demand there was for it. So we decided we needed to expand it. We needed to expand it in an area that was extraordinarily popular, which was character experiences, character meet and greets, particularly princess oriented meet and greets, expand some of the attractions for younger guests. And again, it had exactly the kind of impact we wanted. You know, the fantasy of the Magic Kingdom is mostly what draws people to Walt Disney World, and it lifted that fantasy, made it 21st century, and My Magic Plus, drifting into it as another big initiative, of course, brought that, used technology to bring that experience to an even higher level, with a level of personalization that instead of hello child number 385 today, right, meeting a princess, you know, hello Bobby, you know, hello Cindy, because our cast could be turned on to who you were precisely, not one of many.
Right.
And that lifted for a child that, that is a full believer in the fantasy that that princess lives in that cottage or that castle, when he or she meets that princess, it becomes so much more real that they have the magic of knowing who they are. And like that, knowing our guests on a one-by-one personalized basis has really enhanced that experience in a way that that our guests are encouraged to plan in advance, because they can have a more personalized experience when they plan in advance. And we've known forever that the more time people spend planning and the more they commit to before they leave their home in Cleveland, Boston, New York, Georgia, the more time they spend with us when they come into Central Florida. If they come, you know, kind of like, oh, where am I? There's a million distractions, and some of those distractions successfully attract them. If they come with a very strong Walt Disney World itinerary, they spend a lot more with us. So that's the monetization behind it. Cruise ships, you know, was a very small boutique business for us with two ships. It's still a boutique business with four ships, but they were so over-demanded, so overbooked, that it seemed evident that that we could fill two more ships. And of course, we have. They basically sail it virtually 100% full, still at the highest load factors by a huge margin relative to any other cruise line, and a price premium relative to other cruise lines. But also, like every business, the use of technology, the experience that is being offered in that business continued to evolve from when we launched our first ships 20 years ago till today. So having new inventory on the ocean was also a big driver there. So, you know, you've all followed our theme park results. We've done extremely well for a business of its size and maturity here domestically, adding, you know, double digit, sometimes 20% quarter on quarter growth like this previous quarter. And we're very happy with the direction. It's a business that we feel we have the true definition of competitive advantage, and we want to continue to invest in that around the world.
A question people are asking, you know, this from all your years there, is pricing. So is there a ceiling to pricing, and what factors drive your ability to take price at any given time?
So 30 years ago, Frank Wells asked me that question when we were thinking of going from 1650 to 1850. Jay, is this the ceiling on pricing? I think that the irony of that question is that, you know, we price on a value basis, and we keep a very, very close check on what the value proposition is for our guests and the feedback they give us about the value of a day in one of our parks versus the value of trying to cobble together some other form of entertainment for their family. And I think that we're still incredibly comfortable with that value equation, not because we like it, but because our guests keep telling us that, yes, wow, you guys continue to invest in the business, continue to bring it to the next level. The experience is great. It's very hard for my kids to take, for me to take my kids out and them not turn to me after 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, and say they're bored. And I can do that for 10 continuous hours. I'm all in on that. And I think that's pretty much what our guests continue to tell us. So, you know, we tend to price more at what we think of as an entertainment CPI than the general CPI, so which is a couple of points above. We are judicious in the decisions we make about it. If they're not made, you know, willy-nilly, they're not automatic, they're different across the different spectrum of buyers, from single day to multi-day and best customer and so on and so forth. And so far, we feel pretty comfortable that we can continue to do that. But be assured that we keep a very, very close look on it.
Right. And another question people always ask, you know the answer, is impact of foreign exchange, impact of oil prices. What's your history of single biggest
Okay,
determinant?
So oil prices, I can pretty definitively say, after 30 years with a company, have no bearing whatsoever on our attendance. Gasoline, no matter how expensive it is such a minor component of any, not only Disney, you know, travel to Disney, but any travel is unaffected by rising gasoline prices, because it tends to be $20 more on your vacation, or $25 more on your vacation, because gasoline's selling at $4.85 versus $3.25 last year. Having said that, there was one period during gasoline shortage in the 70s that we were affected, just in full disclosure. Foreign exchange, and that
I'll
was...
look out for that.
Yeah, that was... I can't get gasoline at any price, so I'm not driving to Walt Disney World. Foreign exchange, so we talked a little bit about this on our call. Interestingly, if you look across our top five or six feeder markets, there is absolute variation in what's happened relative to the dollar. Some currencies are extremely weak relative to the dollar versus a year ago. Some are much stronger to the dollar versus a year ago. And you can't match that up with the attendance trends. So foreign exchange in and of itself does not seem to be a driver of our theme park attendance. Now, I think if foreign exchange rates reflect fundamental economic weakness, credit crisis, et cetera, I think that has more of a, could have more of a bearing on it. But remember that people are making, that are traveling internationally, so, you know, our big feeder markets, Brazil, UK, Canada, Mexico, people who are traveling internationally are also making that decision relative to other international destinations, which complicates the dynamic, because you don't know what exchange rates have done relative to those. So if you're a Brazilian and you're saying, well, at some point I want to take my family to Europe, at some point I want to take my family to Asia, at some point I want to go to the U.S., you are trading off, you know, against a very complex set of decisions. Our goal is to make our destinations as absolutely as appealing as they can be, and be at the top of that consideration list.
Okay. Let me turn to consumer products. What inning would you guys say we're in for monetizing Frozen? Or you view this as an evergreen franchise like Mickey that just grows even without a film release?
Top of the third, Mets at bat, still don't have a hit.
And they won't win in September.
Yeah,
okay.
Little problem.
Okay.
Look, we talk about Frozen as the most recent example, and we'll come back and talk more specifically about it. But if you go back and look at last year, we had 11 franchises across the company that did more than $1 billion in retail sales. And those franchises span Mickey and Minnie, which are true evergreen properties, to properties that have been created more recently, whether it's Avengers, Frozen, Cars, Planes, more recent creations of the Walt Disney Company. And what we try to do is create great IP and then exploit it, not just in an initial window, but if we have truly great IP, exploit it over a very long period of time, cross-territory, around the world, different businesses, etc. So if you go back and look at Cars, as just an example, the original Cars came out about 10 years ago. And I remember when Cars came out, there was an enormous surge in consumer products around the cars themselves. And there was a question about, you know, could we support it? How would we support it? And in the subsequent years, we supported the franchise through Cars Tunes, which was the shorts that we created. We made a sequel. We talked about Cars Land and California Adventure. We've done a lot to support the franchise. It's great IP, so those individual products or projects were all attractive to us. But Cars is still north of $1 billion in terms of its retail sales. So that is now a franchise that's been around for 10 years, and we think will continue for a very long period of time. Frozen comes along, massive global box office success. Obviously, we were sort of behind on the consumer product side because the magnitude of the appeal surprised retailers, licensees, surprised us to some extent. So there was a little bit of a catch-up phase, and you saw that flow through last year, back to school, Halloween, and the holidays. And we view Frozen as another evergreen franchise. So what are we doing to support Frozen? We've put characters in the parks. We made a wonderful and very well-received short that ran before Cinderella, which was our recent live-action film, also successful. And Bob announced at the annual meeting that we'd be making a sequel to Frozen coming out, you know, down the line. So, you know, we view Elsa and Anna as important, appealing characters. Folks around the world have really been attracted to them, and they find them very appealing. And we will support those characters and that franchise for a long period of time. And we think it will continue to draw, you know, pretty significant benefit for the company for the foreseeable future.
Okay. In my last 5 minutes, let me walk through some of these.
Sure.
From OTT.
Like the rapid fire round.
Exactly. Double jeopardy. Have you ever, do OTT, ever see ESPN going a la carte? And ever is a
well, you know, that's a question that gets asked a lot. I will tell you this. We have looked deeply at the consumer value equation. Because that will be all, it won't be technology. It won't be availability. It won't be the newest flavor of the month that will cause, an a la carte world. It won't even be the content providers agreeing to go a la carte. It will ultimately hinge on whether consumers will find value in an a la carte orientation relative to the, you know, some form of a bundled orientation. And I think that if you look at the production values or the production value and literally the production costs behind the most popular networks out there, figure out what that has to be priced to a more limited audience, plus what it's going to take in terms of the cost of broadband delivery to your home outside of a bundle, you will not come up with a package that suits anyone that that is not very close in price to, you know, what we think of today as expanded basic, or, you know, what will maybe evolve into bundling in different configurations. So we believe that that because of the incredible deal that people get in the MVPD ecosystem relative to the to broadband delivery and the add-ons that they may want to do over the top, as well as, you know, the basic high quality, high production value, in parens, high cost channels that they are getting as part of the bundle, it's very hard to imagine a world where everybody selects what they want and then adds to their own high-speed broadband to have that delivered to them. So so I don't, in the foreseeable future, see a completely fragmented, over-the-top a la carte system.
Okay. Can you discuss how you plan on grouping ESPN Online and growing monetization online and maybe help change on the linear side? So I know at your ESPN Investor Day, you talked a lot about the size of ESPN Online. So yesterday you had a...
Yeah, look, ESPN is a true multi-platform business today. So I think in last year's upfront, if you look at our ad sales of more than $1 million, I think 80%+ of those ad sales were multi-platform. So advertisers were buying at least two or three different platforms. Television, radio, print, online, whatever the case is. Our digital business, we don't disclose the numbers, but it has continued to grow nicely. You saw the relaunch of our website. Part of what's behind that is greater integration between linear content and digital content. And, you know, we have an objective to create content and then allow us that will ultimately be distributed over multi-platforms. Watch ESPN is a different entity entirely. That is, you know, a true simulcast, you know, of what we're running on the linear networks. Usage there continues to grow as well, and we are doing a better job of monetizing that usage. Ed is selling more and more advertising on the Watch ESPN platform every year. So I think we feel great about the true integration of our linear networks and our other platforms. Because I think, frankly, that's how sports fans are viewing content. People aren't just sitting in front of the television anymore. If they're at the kids' soccer game or dance recital, they might want to watch an event on Watch ESPN. They're checking SportsCenter in terms of the app to keep up with scores, live game casts, whatever the case may be. So we're trying to go where the consumers are, And I think ESPN is out in front of everyone in terms of its multi-platform.
Right. And you have bought those rights. That's part of the moat you've built.
We have cleared just about all the major rights now. There's, you know, the one exception where we don't have Monday Night Football on mobile devices because the NFL is a separate deal with Verizon. But other than that, I think we have cleared virtually all major sports rights for Watch ESPN.
A mobile is defined as a phone, not a tablet.
Yeah, mobile, yeah. There are a variety of definitions, but essentially if the device is used to make phone calls, Verizon has the rights. Any other device, we have the rights. So desktops, iPads, you know, anywhere else people will want to watch a football game.
And that's in the cost of what you've paid for. Last question, 33 seconds left, is... In negotiation with Netflix, or as you put it, just in general, more content on other people's players, do you get to see data or views or any kind of information of who's watching, when they're watching? Is there any information loop coming back to you guys? And if so, will that change?
Well, I think going forward, that is an essential part of coming together with people who are delivering direct to consumers. I think that, 10 years ago, it wasn't top of mind for any content producers to want to understand that kind of data in detail and the who kind of data, and who was viewing. That's changed. I don't want to get into the details of any particular deal that we've done, but suffice to say that, we are in a world where knowing consumers is a huge value, and we are quite focused on that.
Okay. Jay, Lowell, thank you guys last night for coming. I really appreciate
it.
My pleasure. Now we're going upstairs on the elevator to have lunch.